Hi everyone, welcome back to the Lake Podcast, where we speak to authors on their recent books on South Asia. I'm your host, Karthik Nachipan. In this episode, we are going to be talking about a disease, cancer, and how it's endured and lived by individuals that make up Delhi's urban poor. In Enduring Cancer, Life, Death, and Diagnosis in Delhi, anthropologist Dwai Banerjee painstakingly shows us how Indians live with and die of cancer by chronicling the social relations of cancer, which leads to acts of love, concealment, anger, and pain that individuals face as they struggle with the disease. How do the urban poor in Delhi live with cancer? How do they negotiate and manage it personally through their kin and communities and through inadequate health systems that effectively fail them at every juncture? Through ethnographic fieldwork in Delhi's largest cancer care NGO and public hospital, Banerjee describes how patients battle and endure a series of infrastructural failures embedded in India's post-colonial health system. The system aside, Banerjee also maps how cancer pervades the social worlds and lives of individuals, testing their resolve and strength. A cancer diagnosis in Delhi and other parts of India reveal and reinforce endemic issues of poverty, gendered and structural violence, and illness. Besides ethnographic work, Banerjee also uses media representations, specifically cancer memoirs and films, to depict a social landscape where cancer or is valorized for different purposes. More broadly, however, Enduring Cancer compels us to focus on and unveil the structural systemic failures individuals across developing countries like India confront that profoundly affect how they respond, if they can. To understand cancer and its treatment, we also have to grapple with incumbent post-colonial realities, which manifest through the realities of poverty, endless precarious work, the lack of effective and sustainable safety mechanisms that could better regulate how individuals respond to a disease like cancer. So let's focus less on individual suffering and zero in on the systemic failures that make cancer a death sentence for most individuals in the Global South. Here's Dwai Banerjee on Enduring Cancer, Life, Death, and Diagnosis in Delhi, published by Duke University Press in 2020. Thank you so much for doing this. I want to begin by asking what your journey was with the book. Did it begin as a study of cancer in India, or as you write in the book, did cancer allow you to challenge certain stubborn tropes, that of it being a disease of the West, that Indian bodies could not adapt to diseases like cancer and withstand pain, and that patients, not systems, deserve blame for a diagnosis? So how did this begin?
Firstly, thanks for the invitation. It's really good to be able to talk about the book, especially during a pandemic where it's hard to get a sense of how it's circulating. The book actually began very differently than from how it ended up. It started as an attempt to think about the space of ICUs in Indian medical care, partly because of the rise of these big hospitals in and around Delhi that have come up since the 90s with a lot of funding from international organizations, new Indian capital. And so what interested me about that was a new landscape of public health that seemed to be, or of health in general, that seemed to be emerging in and around Delhi, where the meaning of private hospitals or what that meant seemed to be really shifting into these big mega hospitals that were basically luxury five-star facilities with their own helicopter pads, with patients flying in from all over the world. So I was really intrigued by this phenomenon, and I wanted to think about what intensive care looked like in this situation, particularly given how intensive care demands these urgent interventions, how it's supposed to serve a local population around the hospital itself. But very soon while doing that ethnography, I was sort of dissatisfied with the way in which the space of the intensive care unit itself makes it very difficult to get a sense of long trajectories of illness. And you get this one snapshot at a very critical moment in a patient's biography. And that led me to thinking more about what illness really looks like when you put it in context of life that is already often under severe duress. And when you don't break up the idea of illness into moments of critical breakdown and ordinary well-being. And so that while beginning that project, that coincided with my introduction to one of the main organizations I work with, CanSupport, which does home-based patient care for patients often with advanced cancer, and serves local urban poor populations. And working with them basically opened up a completely different way of thinking about health in India and health amongst the people that they kind of focus on, the urban poor, where something even as devastating like cancer was not the first time that the ability of someone to sustain one's life came into question. It was one of a series of breakdowns that many people had already undergone. And that became a way for me to think about health, not in these moments of distress, when people come to hospitals, often under severe pressure, but how health is actually always under threat when one lives in conditions of either poverty or not even necessarily dire poverty, but given the state of public health in India, even amongst the urban lower middle class and middle class, how certain episodes of illness can change one's class position very drastically. So all this to say that I started thinking less about intensive care and more about healthcare as a long trajectory in a person's life, particularly because that became, to me, a way of thinking about what is wrong with public health in India, that it intervenes in these moments of breakdown, whereas health and healthcare distress does not often function that way. It functions in a much more durable way. And what rethinking public health might look like interested me about cancer then was not that it was something that came into a patient's life and then ruptured it into a what shifted my attention to cancer was both the opportunity to work with a group of people who were looking at health already as a long period of duress within people's lives by going to their homes, by understanding their biographies, their family situations, their neighborhoods, and the challenge of thinking of a disease that is very often perceived to be a moment of critical breakdown in an otherwise ordinary life, the challenge of looking at that and turning it around and suggesting that cancer actually fits into an already difficult healthcare biography isn't a moment of rupture and therefore requires us to reimagine healthcare. not in as episodes of breakdown and normalcy, but as a durably difficult experience in patient biographies.
So the book focuses on what you call the social relations of cancer, right? Or the efforts of patients, families, physicians, and workers to manage a cancer diagnosis. So cancer, in other words, as you described, arrives in a fluid, testy, capacious, and stratified social world, which then affects the trajectory and course of the disease. So how people endure cancer. And I want to ask about the use of the word enduring here, and why you found that to be apt instead of, say, surviving or resisting or even resilience. What does endurance convey?
That's a great question, because I struggled with using that word, particularly because there is this idea that the way to intervene into diseases like cancer, and especially cancer, is to build up the resilience of individual patients, to strengthen their ability as individuals to cope with the disease. So for example, and this is not only an Indian phenomena, but a sort of global phenomena, patient survivor, survivor campaigns that ask you to basically run for life or donate to charities are all centered around an idea of getting better by becoming more optimistic in one's outlook towards the disease. There's an idea built into this idea of survivorship that truly what is at stake is a patient's individual willpower or a patient's individual capacity to withstand and be resilient. And my hope through the book was to say exactly the opposite, that the burden of understanding what happens and how to cope with the disease should be placed not on the patient who is already under severe distress, but on the healthcare system that has produced that kind of distress in the first place. And so distress is not an innocent abstract category. It's the product of a particular healthcare system. And that's something that gets now more specific to cancer in India, where given the lack of attention that has been paid to non-communicable diseases like cancer in India's post-colonial history, there is no sustained public health effort or a coherent public health effort to deal with the problem. And what that ends up doing is bringing patients into hospitals when curative interventions or interventions that would help quote-unquote surviving are already past the point where patients' lives are already past that point. So then what does it mean to ask a patient to be resilient, to be optimistic, to be a survivor when a public health system has already put that beyond their reach? And that's why I turn to endurance as something different from resilience, particularly because enduring pointed me to the durability of distress in patients' lives, how healthcare had always been something very difficult for patients to access, and how cancer added to this distress wasn't this new, unforeseen, unprecedented event, but a long period of, but a kind of new episode in an already difficult life. Now, enduring can again just seem like asking patients or privileging the experience of certain patients who have the capacity to endure. That's not what I'm trying to get at with endurance. What I'm trying to get at is that the lives of patients who are asked to deal with cancer past the point of curative intervention is already going to be an extremely difficult experience. What enduring helps point me to is thinking about the very small piecemeal strategies that then patients have to devise in order to carve out the last few months or years of their life. And therefore, paying attention to patients' will, patients' agency in a way that doesn't suggest that they are just victims of the public health system. It still tries to keep in view how patients' very astutely navigate a very difficult situation. At the same time, it doesn't buy into the survivorship discourse that says that this is a way out for patients, that if they are able to creatively negotiate their disease, they will escape from it. Endurance basically points me to a point in between where the strategies that I saw patients devising was not a way out. It did not offer an answer, but it helped negotiate a difficult situation for the past for the months that a patient had to live, for a few patients, for the little time that they were given. So endurance was basically a way for me to think both of a patient's agency, keeping that in view, but also remembering that this agency was extremely overdetermined by a healthcare system and that it only left very little space for maneuver.
I want to move and talk to you about concealment now, which is a key part of the lived experience of cancer patients in Delhi. And you show how they prefer to conceal their cancer diagnosis from others, including family and others in their neighborhood and community. And at times, this is a very strategic choice because it could disrupt or destabilize those family ties. And most possible, maybe because of stigma. It also shows the dangers or threats that lurk amongst your own, the violence that's embedded within these networks, right, around you that could harm you at any moment. And you call this space the subjunctive, which is kind of like the liminal or prolonged process of hoping and pretending if you're the cancer patient. Right? Can you shed light on how you made sense of this concealment, which I think subverts existing assumptions and views that concealment or a lack of disclosure of a diagnosis is due to a lack of understanding or denial, right? Which when it isn't.
Again, that's a great question. And for concealment, for me, concealment is a paradigmatic example of what I try to mean with the idea of endurance. It's one of those ways in which patients and families figure out how to take in a disease that has been thrust upon them, but not just be victims to a health system that is thrusted upon them in a way that leaves them with very little chance of survival. So as a strategy, then concealment indicated to me how a patient would deal with a diagnosis that was often a diagnosis that would lead to a near certain death in the future. Concealment was one of those paradigmatic strategies of endurance that helped me to see how patients carve out a space of agency, even when they've been diagnosed at a stage of their disease when there's very little to be done. It appeared to me as something that allowed them to continue to live within a space of hope, at the same time as understanding very clearly that the hope was very contingent and provisional, that there was perhaps very little space for them to create a way to live on with the disease, that death was a near imminent phenomena. And so that was a puzzling thing for me. On the one hand, you have a diagnosis that is often terminal. At the same time, you have patients living in this world of hope and pretending that they have, that their lives are not going to be completely overwhelmed by this really difficult diagnosis. There are two ways then of thinking about this. And the first way is in the way that global health and public health interventions usually think about it, that it's patients' way of denying their disease. They've been given a difficult diagnosis, and because of quote unquote ignorance or illiteracy or whatever ways of undermining patients' knowledge you want to use, global public health treats this as a problem. And there are many interventions around educating people, getting them out of this space of denial, bringing them into a confrontation with the truth of their disease. And in my experience doing ethnography, concealment was never necessary. It was never an act of denial. There was the very fact that these patients had come to hospitals and were seeking care immediately made clear that they were not living in some space of ignorance or denial. They were seeking care by choosing not to talk about it in explicit terms. They were not harming their own healthcare trajectory. They were in fact dealing and diagnosing a healthcare system from their own point of view, which had left them with this very little, with this difficult diagnosis, with very little space for maneuver, and responding to it with this agential strategy of living in a space of hope that meant cancer would not overdetermine every move they would make after this diagnosis, at the same time as they would seek ways of looking for treatment, looking for ways of palliating pain that came towards the end. So for me, it was then a strategy and a very agential one on the part of patients that was, in fact, a very acute diagnosis of a public health system that had failed them at every step of the way. And so it was the opposite of ignorance and denial. It was actually a very interesting it was the opposite of denial. It was a way of acknowledging the disease and the effect it had on them and the effect it would have on their relations with families and neighbors and so on. And this brings me to the second part of the answer, which is the stigma around the disease. And that's another thing that global public health is very interested in, trying to destigmatize cancer, quote unquote. And to me, it became interesting to think about why there is stigma in the first place. And the traditional way of thinking about stigma is to say that there's something cultural about it. And this has been said in many contexts across the world, that culture holds people back from understanding and dealing with the truth and reality of biomedicine. And yes, certainly there are cultural reasons behind a patient's desire to hold back talk of their disease, but that wasn't necessarily the most interesting or most operative way of thinking about concealment as it became clear to me during ethnography. It wasn't culture as much as it was political economy that made concealment a necessary practice. And it was political economy in two senses. One, cancer was stigmatized not because it had these cultural associations with some sort of diseases that had that were categorized as morally or ethically dubious. The reason cancer was stigmatized was because it was so close to death, and therefore the discomfort around death easily bled into a discomfort around talking about cancer. And the reason that cancer was a diagnosis that was so close to death was a part of a political economy of health that meant that it had been diagnosed too late. So I wanted to shift the idea of stigma away from culture and towards political economy, suggesting that it was stigmatized because of healthcare, the failure of public health, and not because of a failure on parts of patients who had these atavistic ideas of culture and the place of disease in culture and place of cancer in culture. So if that's what stigma means, then concealment and non-disclosure isn't a cultural way of dealing with the disease, as a way in which people are held back by their belief systems. Rather, it was again a political economic response trying to understand what would happen to someone, let's say, who had been diagnosed, who was dependent on daily wage labor, and would then need to continue that daily wage labor for however long they could in order to live on the rest of their days. And so concealment was a way to make sure that their livelihood could be sustained in certain cases. In certain other cases, it was a way to make sure that their relationship with family members and neighbors could be sustained, would otherwise basically place them in a zone of social isolation. So there was nothing cultural and backwards about concealment. It was actually, to me, a very active and agential and acute diagnosis of a political economy of health, in which to live with cancer meant to live with a stigma, and the way to deal with that stigma was to conceal in certain ways at certain times.
In a way, concealment is how patients negotiate the disease, but also the broader post-colonial context that you were talking about earlier, and the difficulties of that context in many ways, and how that manifested on patients' lives. Right?
Exactly, and therefore not something that was the same as concealment elsewhere in the world. There was a specificity to it. One can call it post-colonial, and I would call it post-colonial in the sense that public health in the post-colonies have been structured very systematically around communicable diseases rather than non-communicable diseases. And therefore cancer in a post-colonial context often turns out to be the a disease that has always been extremely present, extremely active, yet framed out of view because of how disease and public health have been perceived in global public health in the later half of the 20th century, continuing to the present. So if cancer has been kind of framed out of view, then concealment is not the fault of patients, but the fault of a public health system that has left patients with no choice but to come up with these strategies in order to live with the disease when there are so few options for treatment available.
The next chapter deals with how cancer intersects with conjugality, or how households are affected by the disease. It clearly points out that no relationship is spared from the scourge that's cancer, and that these effects are also gendered. Women are able to gain power over their husbands diagnosed with cancer, which allows certain forms of resistance, and as you identify, speech to rise and potentially change their scenarios. As I read, I was wondering if you'd come across cancer patients that were also women and how that affected households, or is it maybe the fact that women are just not in positions to seek and access care or even a diagnosis when it comes to cancer?
Well, that's a great question. And this is where concealment and speech around the disease becomes a fraught question. So for me, it is important to say that concealment is an agential active strategy for patients to deal with a diagnosis that has been thrust upon them by a failing public health system. But at the same time, it exists within a very gendered landscape of care where the diagnosis would be hidden from women, often under the assumption that women would not have the psychological capacity to deal with it and therefore needed to be protected in some sort of way. And so in particular instances, once it intersects with gender most clearly in the way that I was able to see it, it can be a way of stratifying the experience within households, within a particular set of people. And so women were often shielded in a way by children, by parents, by husbands, and quote unquote kept in the dark. But even in these instances, I would suggest that there was much more going on here where it wasn't that women were necessarily unaware of what was going on then. They were shielded, but given the complex dynamics of the disease, given that they were often taken to cancer hospitals with the word clearly demarcated in several languages, it was rarely ever the case that women didn't know what was going on. It was part of a complex situation of managing, again, the hierarchy of gender relations, where women were always aware, but played along with this act of protection, act of condescension, and then played along with it while being fully aware of what was going on. At the same time, given my role as an ethnographer, being male, my access was much more with male patients. And so therefore it became easier for me to see what happened, as I do in this chapter, when male patients were diagnosed, and male patients who had often been extremely abusive in the past and had often put their wives under severe distress in context of, let's say, domestic abuse. What happened in these instances when a cancer diagnosis then entered into a power relation, as it always did, where that male power was not taken away, but inflected in a particular direction, where male patients then became even more dependent than they were on the care and labor of their wives. And in these instances, it became really interesting to me to see women express a sort of agency through the language of care, through the way that they were the point of a kind of intervention through which their husbands would be kept alive, but express it without, express care, and at the same time, it became care, as I saw it, when women extended it to husbands who had been previously abusive, became a way for me to think about how care was always entangled with past histories of violence. And so when this sort of care was being extended, it also became a point at which women sometimes were able to express these past histories of abuse that had been buried and repressed in the context of their lives before the diagnosis of cancer that their husbands had been given. But it also became very important for me to say that this was not an overturning of a gender relation. It was just a moment of opening where women often expressed these past histories, had a certain amount of agency through the care that they were expected to transact. But in the end, the idiom of reconciling with the disease, of becoming, coming to terms as a conjugal unit, as a family, again put them in a difficult situation where they were asked again to repress these past histories of violence and come to terms and give their husbands a kind of love that they required given the context that they were in. And so this difficult intersection of care and violence, of love and past histories of abuse really was intensified in these moments of cancer. So then the disease just became a kind of diagnostic aperture for me to see what happens when long histories of abuse are put under pressure by a life-threatening episode of illness. And my answer to that would be to say that at these moments, social relations, including those of conjugality, came under pressure in a moment of cancer diagnosis, but were always implicated in a longer history of social relations that were already always stratified. And therefore, cancer just became, again, another episode through which social relations would be inflected, but would only make sense if one were to keep in focus the difficult stratifications in gender and class and caste that had pre-existed the diagnosis. Things would never completely overturn with cancer, but it would be infected and stressed in a particular way, often revealing the past, not changing it in the future.
You referenced your fieldwork in your previous response, and I want to ask about that, which focused around studying patients and medical care as an observer with two organizations. One was CanSupport, an NGO, and the other was at AIIMS, the All India Institute of the Medical Sciences, the most prestigious hospital in Delhi. You were observing patients, but also how these care providers worked with patients at these critical times when they were at their most vulnerable. You do mention in the book your method is one of hesitancy. How did you balance being sensitive and hesitant with the need to remain attentive and active as an observer and an ethnographer there?
That's a great question. And I suggest my method is one of hesitancy to indicate that the caregivers I was working with were themselves ethnographers of their own right in certain ways. Many of them had spent decades understanding how cancer had entered into these long histories of kinship violence, of gender relations. They were all acutely aware of the difficult relationship between social life and life-threatening diagnosis. So my entry into this space as an ethnographer would be deceptive for me to say that my entry into this as an ethnographer was the first time that this difficult relationship between social stratification and illness was being brought into visibility. Rather, it became interesting for me to understand how the diagnosis of social relations by caregivers and doctors was already taking place, how they already understood these social relations to be put under duress by a cancer diagnosis, and the limits of how they understood these social relations and the extent to which they understood these social relations to be implicated in political economy. So to put that in another way, I often held back because I understood that caregivers were already negotiating a very difficult terrain of what could be said and what should be said, of how to communicate and how much to communicate, and how these processes of communication were built on caregivers' understanding of what was already going on in families and neighborhoods. And so me intervening here and being very active had the danger of overturning these very complex and nuanced process of negotiations that were always underway between caregivers and patients. So for that reason, it was important for me to hold back and observe. And what that helped me to see then was the way in which caregivers understood social relations and then worked upon them. And so it's very easy to say the doctors only work upon biology, they only look at cancer and then bracket out all the social aspects of that disease, particularly in the place that I was working at, in the palliative care unit at AIIMS, doctors were far ahead of the curve in thinking about the social aspects of the disease. In fact, they understood, because they were intervening into particularly pain, that it wasn't just an outcome of biology, that it was also an outcome of social stratification, of gendered relations, of kinship difficulties, and that to alleviate pain, they had to look into all these different textures of social relations and often mend these difficult social relations. And that was a fascinating thing for me to observe, because it's very easy to dismiss the work of doctors, as people often do, as uncaring, as and especially in a place like AIIMS, where doctors are already under severe duress in terms of infrastructural limits, to just attribute to them a sort of medical paternalism, where they don't really care about their patients, they only do what little they can in the time they're given. To me, there was no deficit of empathy in the work of these palliative care, and I'm speaking very specifically about the people I worked with, palliative care professionals interested in alleviating pain. And so it became important to see what kind of empathy was at play here. And I saw an enormous amount of empathy transacted on a one-to-one basis between doctors and their patients, even under the incredible constraints that they were placed within in a public health hospital that saw millions of patients every year. At the same time, there was a limit to this empathy. And the limit was that it was transacted on a one-to-one basis. And however empathetic doctors were, empathy was not a persuasive response to a political economy that seemed to be constantly reproducing the distress that it was trying to address. So a one-to-one relation of empathy was the best that a doctor could do, that it's the best that a caregiver could do. But empathy was not the answer to a post-colonial public health system that has been chronically underfunded. It was, again, a provisional response. If concealment was a provisional response on the part of patients, empathy was a provisional response on the part of doctors. It would not, in my mind, solve the public health crisis that we're undergoing. And in a strange way, this became really clear to me reading up on what was going on around COVID-19 and where doctors and doctors were being really celebrated for the first time as really empathetic, as the front line of public health, as doing work that was more difficult than anyone could imagine. But again, in these moments where their empathetic and their tireless interventions were being recognized, it became clear again that COVID-19 was not going to be addressed through doctors' empathy. What needed to be done was not just an emergency response around this or strengthening the resilience of doctors in these moments, but rather to rethink public health and the reasons that it became so difficult and the reasons that all the burden of actually intervening into a difficult public health crisis was again placed on individual doctors and nurses and caregivers and not on the institutions that would need to be rethought in order to deal with such an epidemic. So like cancer, so similarly with COVID-19, the answer to these difficult public health crises is not more empathy. There is already an abundance of empathy. It is an attempt to kind of tie that empathy together with an infrastructure, with that empathy that can actually play out in a way that helps patients in distress, that doesn't leave them, that doesn't bring them into the hospital only at the last moments of incredible crisis, but allows doctors the space to actually provide empathetic care in a way that is tied up with the political economy of the disease and not a way to deal with the after effects of the political economy of the disease.
The last two chapters, which I enjoyed, they cover cancer memoirs and Bollywood films and how these forms of representation cover the reality of people living with cancer in India. I think these films and memoirs infuse endurance with a different, more positive meaning or ways through which the disease can be managed through sacrifice, restitution, and resilience. I think what you show is that what these films show, cancers could be crises that have meaning and could be resolved eventually, right? How did these alternate forms of representation, popular representation, balance or add to your ethnographic registers?
That's a great question. It only came to me much later after finishing the ethnography that if I had suggested in my ethnography that concealment was such an operative principle in the everyday life of cancer, there was a profusion of speech and a cultural production around it in different registers, not at the everyday, but in the worlds of memoirs, in the worlds of film, all the way from the 1950s to the present. If public health has framed out cancer from view, Bollywood films actually have kept it very much within its purview right from the earliest days of its appearance in the post-colony, in post-independent India. And at the same time, films and memoirs have changed very much in the history of post-colonial India. For me, it's important to make a distinction between the memoirs and films often because they have two very different responses to the same question. Often what I would say in cancer memoirs is the reproduction of this global trope of survivorship, of basically patients being asked to quote unquote love their cancer or to come to terms with their cancer and therefore embrace the disease as something that would help them refashion their lives and their selves in this new way. And they could become better people, in fact, if they were able to come to terms with how the cancer, with how cancer had kind of opened their eyes to their own prior failings. And to elaborate on that a little bit, often cancer is still seen as the failing of a patient rather than a failing of a healthcare system. And even today, the government of India's public health campaigning around cancer is to suggest that patients need to do better. They need to drink less. They need to be abstinent. They need to change their modern lifestyle behaviors and therefore become less susceptible to the disease. Memoirs often reproduce these tropes that are prevalent not just in India, but elsewhere in the world, that said that it was really the patient's fault that they'd contracted the disease, and the way out was to become better people, and therefore embracing the disease, to love cancer, which was the title of one of the books, meant to basically acknowledge that patients had done something wrong in the past, that was why they had got cancer, and now they could become different people by embracing the lessons that cancer had imparted onto them on how to be basically better moral beings in the future and not be susceptible to disease. And this was really troubling, obviously, because it reproduced everything that I found wrong with the way that cancer was being publicly understood. At the same time, there were many memoirs that fought against this way of characterizing the disease. And those were the ones I wanted to center on because they were often extremely aware that there was no easy out in the context of being diagnosed at a very late stage because of the way that public health is structured. And so these were memoirs that were very attentive to the impossibility of any sort of easy resolution, of any sort of survivorship that was available. These were memoirs that basically understood that death was a part of a cancer diagnosis, and that the work of a patient was often not to become better, but often to understand and reconcile with the anger and grief that was really legitimate for them to feel, and to understand how that grief and anger, not just at themselves, but at a health system that had let them down, was valid, and that this anger needn't be resolved, that it needn't be turned into a discourse of optimism and survivorship, that it had to just be experienced and lived with. So there was memoirs that did that, and it was, I found it important in my book to kind of pay attention to these kinds of memoirs rather than the ones that were dominant and globally circulating. Films did something very different. The things that doctors often accuse films of were that it really misunderstood how much medicine had evolved over the years, and that films were really depressing because patients in Bollywood films always died. And so doctors were really angry with these films because they often thought that it misrepresented how much the medical system had actually done in making cancer a livable disease rather than a diagnosis of death. But to me, that seemed kind of counterintuitive because for most patients, cancer was in fact a diagnosis of death, given how public health was structured. And so if films were saying and focusing on the experience of death rather than on the experience of surviving, they were doing something really interesting in actually showing what was going on in everyday life, that death was very much part and parcel of the diagnosis. So films were really interesting to me because they kind of got something that the medical system was, doctors, patients were often trying to frame out, what public health was trying to frame out, that this was often something that could not be transcended and there was no way out of it by being more optimistic or being more cheerful. At the same time, there was a way in which a lot of films that are really kind of popular, some that come to mind immediately, Anand is a good example of this, acknowledged death, but they acknowledged death again by suggesting that there was something to be learned in this experience. And Anand is a really interesting film that basically suggests that patients need to reconcile with their death, not and remain cheerful and optimistic, and therefore teach doctors and society a lesson about enduring and being resilient. And that's where, again, some of these films became interesting, but a little bit difficult to reconcile with, because it again put the burden on patients to be, again, resilient and cheerful and to accept their death. And so that's one way in which Bollywood and post-independent cinema has dealt with it. There are many other ways that it has kind of shifted registers. But at each, and I won't get into details about each of them, but at each point and each decade of cinema, the way that Bollywood responded to cancer was often indicative of what was often going on with the public messaging around the disease, but was often much more sophisticated than the public messaging around the disease, sometimes actually living with the uncertainty that the disease produced, and in those moments, acutely diagnosing what was going on in public health, not transcending the difficulty that the disease produced in life, but actually trying to portray it to the best of the filmmaker's ability and to kind of understand how it kind of lived on in patients' lives.
There's a line in the conclusion which really struck me. I mean, as we persist through this pandemic and how we should think about a post-pandemic life. And you write, and I quote here, "I have developed the idea of cancer as endemic rather than epidemic. Cancer, a disease synonymous with crisis and rupture, is also a matter of slow, chronic, and endemic concern." I think this line is kind of hard to read now, right? Especially when we think that there could have been other ways to deal with something like the coronavirus, especially in a post-colonial environment like India, which is what they're trying to do now, as a crisis that's endemic of catastrophes that challenge, but which could then be handled by the strategies of endurance that you lay out in the book.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have been thinking about this very much over the last 2 years, because the book came out at the beginning of the pandemic, but so much during the pandemic has made me think back to some of the things that I tried to understand in the book, particularly the way in which cancer as a disease is understood as a crisis that emerges and then either goes away or in whatever shape it takes form, it always is an exception to everyday life. It's something that comes in and out of life. It ruptures life into these two moments, life before cancer and life after cancer, where the discourse often is that after cancer, one either returns to normalcy or one doesn't. And those echo very much with the way in which COVID as a crisis is being represented, that it comes out of nowhere, it ruptures people's experience collectively and individually. And then after that, we might return to a normal, and we, for many people, we will return to a quote unquote normal. And so that parallel between thinking about COVID and cancer as crises became really, really clear, where one way of thinking about it is to think about it as a rupture that comes in and out of everyday life and of experiences of illness. But another way of thinking about it, and the way that I was trying to think about it in terms of cancer, was to think about it as part and parcel of everyday life, as part and part of social relations, and as only legible in the context of a broader public health system. So if cancer is a crisis, it is a crisis that is part of a public health crisis that has been the experience of Indian healthcare since the 1950s. So what does it mean to always say that Indian public health is in crisis when that crisis has been going on for 70 years? And what does it mean to overlay one crisis on top of that crisis? To me, then, that means rethinking the idea of crisis in the first place and the idea of thinking of cancer and COVID-19 as crises. If Indian public health has always been in crisis, what does the normal mean? Have we ever really had an experience of the quote-unquote normal? And when we think about COVID-19, thinking about it in this way means that very few people will actually go back to a new normal. Most people will go back to new forms of crises, and cancer being just one of them. If public health is in has always durably been unable to meet the needs of patients, then it's meant that patients have always left with a most patients, the large majority of patients in India, have experienced healthcare always as a matter of crisis. So then both with cancer and COVID-19, I think the important thing to do is to destabilize these narratives of these moments as crises, and to think of them as part and parcel of public health that has made these seem like exceptional events, but in fact, they aren't exceptional as much as they are one in a long series of episodic breakdowns, both in the public health system as well as in the biographies of patients and families. And therefore, rethinking crises and thinking our way out of COVID-19 is to rethink public health. It's not to rethink what to do when it breaks down, but to rethink public health in a way that it isn't an oscillation between breakdown and normalcy, but rather an acknowledgement of public health as always working through crises, as working through moments of breakdown. And then therefore doing simple things like thinking again of what primary care looks like, what basic provisions of helping patients deal with moments of disease, or deal with diseases before they become critical, might look like, what a different imagination of public health should involve going forward.
We usually end with two final questions in every podcast. So I'll do that as well. First is, what was the hardest part of writing the book?
That's a great question. I think the hardest part for me was to understand that there was no easy answer to the question of cancer. What I mean by that is, I've worked earlier with health activists who've made particular demands of the Indian healthcare system. In particular, I've worked with the activists that have come out of the Bhopal gas disaster, where it's clear and easy to see the ways in which the Indian government has very systematically and actively failed a large group of critically ill people. With cancer, those lines of failure are harder to determine, and therefore it's harder for me to understand what an activist response to cancer might look like. For me, I really wanted to come out of this book with a clear sense of activist response to a problem that is incredibly critical to many people's lives. I wanted to come out with a sense of clarity in suggesting that there were these easy solutions that could look at cancer as a particular problem and then produce a set of guidelines and critical sets of intervention that we could mobilize around. Not finding those clear answers was the hardest part for me. But that hard part pointed me to the impossibility of separating cancer from the way in which the systematic, the separating cancer from the kind of structural distribution of vulnerability in public health that doesn't allow for separating cancer from public health in general. There is no way in which I can propose a set of guidelines or a set of interventions through which we can deal with cancer and leave the broader failure of public health out of the picture. There is only dealing with public health. Cancer, as responding to cancer, will be an outcome of dealing with public health in general. And that requires a broader view, and it doesn't allow for an easy out of the disease in itself. The only way I think I'm understanding a proper response to cancer as a disease is through rethinking of public health from the bottom up. And that's hard. It would have been easier to think of a kind of way out of cancer as a disease in itself. It's much harder than to think of a way of reshaping public health more generally. And the hard thing and the hard lesson then to take away is that there is the only way out and the only way forward is to rethink public health. However hard that is, there is no other option. So that is the hard part for me to kind of reconcile with the book. There is no easy answer. The only answer is the difficult one of reshaping public health. And the hardness of that is something that we sort of have to live with and deal with the slowness of an intervention, deal with the difficulties of basically, yeah.
And finally, what are you working on now?
So I'm working on something that is extremely different, perhaps coming out of the experience of the difficulty of trying to find a kind of clarity around what was going on with cancer. I'm turning to a history of computing and a history of physics in 1950s and 1960s India. And in one way, one might think of it as a way to kind of move away from all the messiness and nuances that comes up in this book, the difficulty of kind of finding a way out of the way in which bodies and everyday life is implicated in illness and the difficult ways in which that's always the center of attention and thinking about disease and public health. At the same time, I'm slowly beginning to see points of similarity. And it's in some ways, it might seem a stretch that there's something similar about writing history of computing and writing an ethnography of cancer. But the points at which they kind of begin to coincide for me are visions of thinking about science, technology, and medicine in India in 1950s and 1960s that were much more capacious than they are now. And even thinking back to the history of cancer in the 50s and 60s and thinking of the work of historians like Kavita Sivaramakrishnan, there was a moment at the time of decolonization that there seemed to be different possibilities. And those different possibilities existed around cancer. And I point to them briefly in the book, where India was in the 50s and 60s thinking of cancer as a central and primary public health problem. From the point of view of the present, it's hard to remember that. And it's hard to remember that cancer has always been part of India's public health. Cancer has always been part of the problem of Indian public health, and that the framing of cancer as a non-communicable modern disease and other diseases like malaria and tuberculosis as communicable diseases and the diseases of the developing world. That differentiation was being contested as far back as the 1950s. So looking back to that moment in the history of cancer helps me to kind of defamiliarize the present. I'm doing the same thing with computing, looking back to the 1950s and the way in which computing was being imagined by a new set of actors, scientists, physicists, mathematicians, is a very different way than imagining how computing is understood in the present, where the discourse is so much about outsourcing, about India providing so much of the labor for a global kind of computing world. In the 1950s, the actors I'm interested in were thinking of Indian computing as, again, the kind of center, not the periphery of intellectual production, of manufacturing, of knowledge, where India wasn't going to be the kind of outsourced backwater, but the central metropole of thinking and not innovation as much as a state-led program of computing that would redevelop the nation as at par from the very beginning with the rest of the world. So the first computers I'm looking at were at par with the first computers anywhere else in the world. How did that become, how did that vision, so part of the book then, part of this new project then is to suggest that there was a vision for the nation and the nation's relationship with science and technology that was slowly foreclosed over the decades of post-colonial independence in the same way that a vision of thinking about cancer was slowly foreclosed simultaneously. So yeah, there is a sort of link between the new and the old that I'm only beginning to sort of understand now.
Roy, thank you so much.
And that was Dwai Banerjee, the author of Enduring Cancer, Life, Death, and Diagnosis in Delhi. I'm Karthik Nachipan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.